Hi. Humanity faces a momentous period of transition. Modern civilization is not only in crisis, it confronts a multiplicity of overlapping global crises that are potentially terminal. We're all aware of the devastating findings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The worst case scenario on a business as usual trajectory, you all are aware. Global average temperatures will rise by 6 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. An uninhabitable planet. We now know that this scenario is actually very conservative. The IPCC didn't sufficiently account for the interconnected complexity of global crises. Arctic sea ice coverage, as we've just heard, is now at the lowest level it's been for a million years. It will likely disappear in the summer of 2015. But what does this mean? This has real serious implications. The loss of summer sea ice is linked to the accelerating melt of permafrost, releasing the vast underground stores of methane, about 30 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon. The process is happening much faster than anticipated. Methane concentrations in the Arctic are now averaging about 1.85 parts per million. This is the highest it's been in 400,000 years. If this reaches a tipping point, we could trigger a process of unstoppable runaway global warming, and we could see a rise of 8 to 10 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. Scientists also link the Arctic melt to our increasingly extreme weather. It will mean more colder, stormier winters in the UK and Northern Europe. This, in turn, will damage British and European agriculture. With 4/5 of the United States in drought, prolonged droughts in Russia and Africa, and a lighter monsoon in India, all due to climate change, we're already seeing a global food supply crash that will precipitate dramatic food price spikes. This alone, by itself, will lead to unprecedented food riots in poor countries around the world. By mid-century, if we fail to act, world crop yields could fall by as much as 20 to 40% due to global warming alone. Imagine what this would look like if you factored in other things like energy depletion. In 2010, the International Energy Agency acknowledged that world conventional oil production had most likely peaked in 2006. Future production relying increasingly on unconventional sources like tar sands, oil shale, shale gas, all will be increasingly expensive. But there's been a lot of industry hype, and it's promised to reduce these costs dramatically with new drilling technologies, namely fracking. But this just isn't true. Despite the US having increased its total supply by about 2.1 million barrels per day since 2005, world crude oil production overall has remained largely flat since that very year. Writing in the journal Science, Sir David King, he's our former UK government chief scientist, he confirms that unconventional oil and gas will not be able to produce sufficiently cheap liquid fuels at the same rate as conventional oil. Production rates at shale wells drop off by 60 to 90% within the first year of operation. You don't hear this in the news. Sir King also argues that oil companies have overestimated world oil reserves by about a third. So we're in trouble, folks. To make matters worse, a typical frack job uses about 4.5 million gallons of water. That's what New York City consumes within about 7 minutes. As climate change intensifies then, and drought gets worse, it will make fracking more unsustainable and costly. The problem is that every major point in industrial food production is heavily dependent on fossil fuels, on-site machinery, production of artificial fertilizers, processing, packaging, transport, and storage. About 10% of energy consumed in the US yearly is used by the food industry. So as oil becomes more expensive, this will place massive strain on industrial food production. And it won't be just food. By 2030, on our current course, climate change alone will lead to deaths worldwide of over 100 million people and a 3.2% reduction in global GDP. What happens when we factor in the impact of peak oil? A study this year in the leading journal Energy, again, not heard it in the news, concluded that world oil supply has not increased since 2005, that this was a primary cause of the recession, and that the expected impact of reduced oil supply will mean the financial crisis may worsen. What happens when we factor in the interconnected feedback effects of water scarcity, food riots, civil breakdown, mass migration, state failure? The cost will be amplified tremendously. This is because the growth that we've experienced over the last decades has been tied inextricably to the systematic expansion of debt. Although total world GDP is around $70 trillion, global external debt is at $69 trillion, and global public debt is 64% of global GDP. Meanwhile, the total size of global derivatives trading, the debt-based speculation which got us into this mess, has risen from $1,000 trillion in 2008 to $1,200 trillion this year. An estimate. A number with no relation to the real economy, clearly. It's no coincidence that debt and derivatives have both intensified at the same time, because the speculative investments designed to benefit the 1% are being bailed out by the 99%. So it's only a matter of time before these costs catch up with unsustainable debt. It's time to wake up to the fact that the conventional economic model has run out of steam. Having outlasted its welcome, it's now leading us along a path to self-destruction. The heart of the problem is the skewed structure of our current form of capitalism, which makes endless material growth at any cost a seemingly rational, logical imperative. What is this structure? Let's pin it down. It comes down to who owns the earth. Today's capitalism is based on a completely unnatural condition, where approximately 1 to 5% of the world's population own the entirety of the planet's productive resources, as well as the technologies of production and distribution. This is the outcome of centuries of colonization, imperialism, and globalization, which has centralized control of the Earth's resources into the hands of a few. With the entire planet subjected to the unrestrained logic of endless growth, we're witnessing the accelerated degradation of our natural environment, our resource base, our financial system, as well as our own well-being. These are not separate crises. They are interconnected symptoms of a global crisis of civilization. So how do we respond? We must first awaken to the reality that this isn't the end, but the beginning. What we are witnessing is the collapse of the old paradigm, which, hell-bent on planetary suicide, isn't working. By the end of this century, whatever happens, civilization in its current form will not exist. The question we must ask ourselves is this: what will we choose to take its place? As a species, we're on the cusp of an evolutionary choice. Standing at the dawn of this perfect storm, we find ourselves at the beginning of a process of civilizational transition. As the old paradigm dies, a new paradigm is born. And many people around the world are already making the evolutionary choice to step away from the old. Local communities and grassroots activists are co-creating this new paradigm as I speak from the ground up. In Greece, locals in Athens gave up their salaries to form an eco-village, producing their own food, building sustainable houses, decreasing reliance on money. As austerity wipes out jobs and businesses, the eco-village has become a citizen's hub, giving advice, running workshops, and independent living. In the UK, there are 43 communities producing renewable energy through cooperative ownership structures. These projects are established and run by local residents. They collectively invest their own time and money to install local wind turbines, solar panels, hydroelectric power. The borough of Woking in Surrey is a really good example. They produce 135% of their electricity from renewable energy sources, and they sell energy back to the grid. They earn revenue that feeds back into the local economy. In 2008, 200,000 US households were living off-grid, sourcing their own water, generating their own electricity, managing their own waste disposal. 2 years later, this had jumped to 750,000 households, and it's now rising by about 10% a year. Across the Western world, altogether, there are now 380 transition towns. Their citizens are actively collaborating to make urban life resilient to fossil fuel depletion and climate change. The new paradigm is premised on a fundamentally different ethic, in which we see ourselves not as disconnected, competing units, fixated on maximizing consumerist conquest over one another, but as interdependent members of a single human family. Our economies, rather than being assumed to exist in this vacuum of unlimited material expansion, are seen as embedded in wider society. Economic activity for its own sake is recognized as the pathology that it is. Economic enterprise, which we still value, becomes aligned with the deeper values that make us human. Values like meeting our basic needs, education and discovery, arts and culture, sharing and giving. The values which psychologists say contribute to well-being and happiness, far more than mere money and things. And in turn, our societies are seen not as autonomous entities to which the whole of the planet must be ruthlessly subjugated, but rather as inherently embedded in the natural environment. These grassroots endeavors are pointing us towards a vision, a very coherent vision in which people reverse their irrational investments in counterproductive conflict. Over the last decade, under the old paradigm, we've steadily increased world military spending by about 4.5% annually. In 2011, world military spending totaled $1.74 trillion, rising 0.3% from the preceding year. It just flattened due to the financial crisis. Imagine what we could achieve if we transferred these absurdly huge expenditures on war preparations for the nation into development concerns for the species. Study after study proves that we could successfully transition to 100% global renewable energy infrastructure within the next 30 years, if we made that choice. The cost of the transition would be no more than 1% of the annual national budgets of world governments combined. This implies, however, not just, you know, sending home armed forces, reducing unnecessary weapons production, curtailing the influence of the military-industrial complex. We must convert that very industrial capacity by retraining our workers in the defense industries, re-employing them in the new industries of sustainable peace that can underpin post-carbon civilization. This will generate a new sustainable form of prosperity. Even by today's completely inadequate standards of investment, by 2020, some 2.8 million people in Europe will be employed in the renewable energy sector. This will boost GDP by some 0.24%. Again, imagine, what could we achieve if hundreds of millions of households across Europe came together in their communities to invest their collective resources into each becoming owners and producers of energy? The new energy paradigm is not about corporate-dominated mega-projects. It's about empowering small businesses and communities. Up to 70% of energy is lost in transmission over large distances. So there's massive potential for efficiency gains when power is produced and consumed closer to the source. This model where households, communities, and towns become producers and consumers of clean energy is already being scaled up in Germany with a great deal of success. 20% of the country's electricity comes from renewables, and 51% of those, all the distributed energy generation, is owned by individuals, not by utility companies. This is huge. This is a new paradigm being born as we speak. And it also applies to food. On the one hand, we need to put an end to the inefficiency of the industrial food system. One third of global food production is lost or wasted every year. On the other hand, we must shift away from resource-intensive forms of traditional corporate-dominated agriculture. In many cases, we will find that smaller-scale forms of organic farming, which are more labor-intensive, though less energy and water-intensive, can be more sustainable than current industrial practices. Communal organic farming offers immense potential, not only for employment, but also for households and communities to become local owners and producers in the existing food supply chain. In poorer countries, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food finds that small-scale organic methods of farming could double food production. And a recent University of Michigan study concludes that no pesticide, local forms of organic agriculture, again, no artificial fertilizers, could theoretically be scaled up to sustain high nutritional requirements for not just the entire global population, but potentially an even larger population of 11 billion people. This new paradigm of distributed clean energy production, decentralized farming, participatory economic cooperation offers a model of development free from the imperative of endless growth for its own sake and leads us directly to a new model of democracy based not on large-scale hierarchical control in the representative form, but on the wholesale decentralization of power itself towards smaller local ownership. In the new paradigm, households and communities become owners of capital in their increasing appropriation of the means to produce energy, food, and water themselves. This will ensure that critical decisions about production and distribution of wealth take place in communities by communities, driving political empowerment. But participatory enterprise requires commensurate mechanisms of monetary exchange, which are transparent, free from the fantasies and injustices of the conventional model. In the new paradigm, neither money nor credit will be tied to the generation of debt. Banks will be community-owned institutions, fully accountable to their depositors. And whirlwind speculation on financial fictions will be completely replaced by equitable investment schemes in which banks share risks with their customers and divide returns fairly. The new currency will not be a form of debt money. It will be, if anything, linked more closely to real-world assets. But equally, the very notions of growth, progress, and happiness will be completely, radically redefined. We now know, thanks to research by the likes of psychologist Oliver James and epidemiologist Richard Wilkinson, that excessive wealth in the West has not only failed to make us happy, it has proliferated mental illness and widened social inequalities, which are scientifically linked to the prevalence of crime, violence, drug abuse, teenage births, obesity. I could go on. This doesn't mean that material progress is irrelevant, but that when it becomes the overriding force of society, it is dysfunctional. So we must accept that the old paradigm of unlimited material acquisition is in its death throes. The new paradigm of community cooperation is far more in tune with both human nature and the natural order. This new paradigm may well still be nascent. You know, you don't see it around everywhere. You see it in small pockets, small seeds planted in these disparate places. But as the crisis of civilization accelerates over the next decades, communities everywhere will become increasingly disillusioned and angry with what went before. And in that disillusionment with the old paradigm, the seeds we're planting today will blossom and offer a vision of hope that will be irresistible tomorrow. There's only one question that remains, and I ask you, and I ask you to ask yourselves, are you going to hold fast with the grip of death to the old paradigm? Or will you embrace life to become an agent of the new paradigm of community cooperation? Thank you.